They say marketing is a madman's game. So now we turn it over to the marketing madman with Nick Constantino and Trip Job on Extra 106.3 FM.
Happy Saturday and welcome to the Marketing Madman. Nick Constantino here with the chef Arnaldo Castillo of Tio Lucho's. And this is going to be a fun episode. We're going to break some new ground in this one. Obviously, talking food is something I love. Talking restaurants is something I love. But we're also specifically talking about Peruvian food and cuisine. And I am actually heading to Lima and I will be doing the last segment of this show in Lima. So I think this is perfect timing. So, chef, how are you, sir?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So let's start with a fun one. What do Americans get wrong about Peruvian cuisine? And why has it been a slower draw to get here than some of the other cuisines from around the world?
Man, that's a great question. And not to open up Pandora's box of why there's misconstrued ideas about Peruvian food, but a lot of people because we're closer to like Mexico and we understand those flavors, sometimes they kind of see other Latin American countries as like, there's probably some similarities. And while there are some, with the seasonings or maybe the techniques or the ingredients, Peruvian food is completely different just from all the other Latin American cuisines. And, you know, it's sometimes it feels like an uphill battle when people are coming into the restaurant and we have a huge sign that says Tio Lucho's Peruvian coast.
Yeah.
And they come in. And
ask for a margarita.
Yeah. Or they're like, I want chips and salsa, you know?
I think that's it's correct. That's ignorance. I think it's an ignorant thing. And I say that, go ahead.
Sorry to cut you off, for me, it's important that I wanted to create a platform to then talk and share Peruvian culture. So when someone comes in and they ask for those things, we say, we don't have that, but we do have, these homemade plantain chips with this huancaína salsa that I think would pair kind of well with what you're looking for, you know?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is ignorance towards geography and cultural, because like Peruvian, they're mountains, and people are starting to know that because of Machu Picchu and understand that, but like the continent where Mexico comes in and then starting South America are completely different terrains. Mm-hmm. There's just the coasts are different, the oceans are different, and I think what I found the most fascinating is, when you talk about something like Lomo Saltado, the Chinese influences that came and when they came, mm-hmm. apparently, and I kind of did some research beforehand, but Peru was the first country to allow, in South America, to allow Japanese immigrants in, mm-hmm. which has started an entire part of how sushi in Japan made their way over. So mm-hmm. I think we teach history wrong in America and we kind of just hyper-focus on like white people in Europe and we don't focus on how much the rest of the world is, which is a shame. I'm from New York City, man. Mm-hmm. Like you have everything you can imagine is on every corner in New York City and like everything has its own little pocket of real things, right? And even more so, you mentioned your family's from North Peru, mm-hmm. right? Which is probably completely different from South Peru. And Peru is not a huge country population-wise, mm-hmm. and the cuisine changes so much.
Yeah.
I think one of the beautiful things about restaurants in America nowadays is I think we've gotten to the point where we're starting to kind of separate these things off. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing more regional cuisines come up, and you're mm-hmm. seeing these things, which is just fun because, you mentioned Mexican food. Mexican food changes. Every province has completely different dishes.
Absolutely, yeah.
And to be fair, sometimes Mexican food copies Peruvian food. Because I've had agua caliente, which is pretty much a ceviche ripoff. Like these things are all, everything is.
You mean aguachile?
Fluid. Aguachile.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Agua caliente, because mine had a lot of hot sauce on it. So I just had to throw the caliente in it.
Yeah.
I was on the beach in Cancun and I had one and it was just like a whim. And I just like the real hot sauce. And I just dumped half the bottle on it and I ate it and I won't. It was orgasmic. It was pretty close. So, so talk about Tio Lucho's pop up first. Talk about how you came up as a chef. Because again, you kind of see the celebrity chefs and their popularity has waned and it's come down to the people who kind of grew up community cooking and that's been a more forefront. So talk about how you became a chef and then how Tio Lucho's came to be.
Yeah. I've been in the restaurant industry since I was 15 and I've been cooking professionally for about 10 years now.
Okay.
And, I've been lucky enough to work with some really talented chefs, chefs from the Southeast region. And I've been able to learn so much about techniques and seasonality and ingredients. And that was me going to school.
I didn't
go to culinary school.
Sure.
I just worked in kitchens and kind of picked up my skill set that way. And, eventually I was working for a restaurant group here in Atlanta. It was a great corporate job, and actually that quarantine happened, and that's when I started digging into Peruvian food. I wanted to cook. I'm at the apartment. I'm stuck, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to just cook Peruvian food, the food that I missed growing up, and I was sharing that with my my girlfriend, who's now my wife.
Okay, congrats.
And, thank you. And, you know, that was sort of the start to my pop-up La Chingana, where I started doing tasting dinners around the city of Atlanta and was just focused on introducing Peruvian food, sharing culture, because now I'm cooking in front of guests. I'm, you know, talking about the inspiration behind the dishes. I'm also talking a little bit about the history behind it, because
I love
just going down these rabbit holes and learning about techniques and ingredients. And that was La Chingana. So that was my pop-up. And my idea was I need to create a platform and then transition into a brick and mortar.
Okay. And so you had that mapped out, that that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah, that was my strategy.
So the pop-up scene is probably really misunderstood. I think Atlanta got into it, and then now it's just too much. There's just pop-up, 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 pop-up. Talk a little about that pop-up scene. So this is probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
Not even four years ago? 2021.
Okay, so talk about the pop-up scene. Talk about what it was like in Atlanta. Talk about why you saw that opportunity, because I think it's, again, I think it's a little bit misunderstood.
Yeah, well, the pop-up scene, it gets a little bit oversaturated because you have a lot of people that are coming in and they wanna cook food that, you know, they're inspired to share with guests and you know, the city. But I've always told some of these pop-up chefs that I've done collaborations with, like, make sure you have a strategy. Like, if your goal is to open up a restaurant, well, how are you gonna get to that point, you know? And you have to think of a restaurant, opening a restaurant, or even running your own pop-up holistically. Like, how, you know, you gotta make sure that you are marketing yourself on social media platforms.
Sure. Oh my goodness.
You gotta make sure that
front of house, back of house, businesses, yeah, ordering, balance sheets. Like, it's not an easy task.
I was lucky that, you know, I already was an executive chef when I left my job to go into pop-up. So I already had an understanding of how restaurants run and how to manage a staff. So when I started doing my tasting dinners, it was just me, my wife, and then I would, you know, hit up some homies to help me, you know, execute the dinner. But I love seeing pop-ups come up because that's where they're sharing, you know, the regional cuisines that they grew up with. You know, some of my favorite pop-ups right now are low Asian food, you know, Indian food, et cetera, you know.
Yeah.
So you don't see those restaurants being represented.
Yeah.
So it's up to the pop-ups. That's why it was up to me to create La Chingana and share Peruvian food. Because no one was doing it right.
Yeah, it's crazy. And was there a point where you knew it was time to go brick and mortar? I know you said it was your plan, but was there like a crossover? Like, holy crap, people really dig this. Was there that moment? Do you remember when that moment was, or was it kind of a slow process?
No, that was my goal. It was to open up a restaurant, but I needed to create the platform first, and so that's why I started with the pop up. And then, you know, my personal goal was to create generational wealth for my family to have one day. You know, and so now I have a baby girl. She's 5 months now.
And, oh, you're in the thick of it.
That was the idea, is that I had these real life examples in front of me. My godparents in Buta in northern Peru have had a restaurant for almost 60 years, you know, and that's how they've been able to provide for their family. And I just, that was inspiring for me. And you know, my business partners and et cetera have all been in the restaurant game for years. And so I saw that as a way to create generational wealth, and that's my goal.
Love it. You very rarely hear that, at least people that honest, like, you had a plan, you stuck to it. Most people, I just want to open a restaurant, and they go into it not knowing a clue of what's going to happen and how important this all is.
Yeah, after, yeah.
I love, and I, you know, look, a lot of this has come to the forefront, like a show like The Bear, where like it's just over exaggerated as to how it's happening. But one thing that I know to be true, if the dishwasher is off that day and your dishes aren't clean, you're screwed. Like, there's so much that goes into a restaurant working, like so many little nuanced things that people don't understand. Yeah. And the expectations have changed, right? Everybody wants a farm to table, holistic, that's organic experience. Mm-hmm. And like, sometimes the cuisine doesn't even call for that. Sometimes the cuisine doesn't need to be that. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I loved about New York was like, no one got into all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, the best places were just the Dominican family that came fresh over and was just cooking what they knew to cook, right? And Atlanta has it. Buford Highway has plenty of spots that are just exactly that. Mm-hmm. But I think we've kind of gone away from that. So early days, so Tio Lucho's, you know, talk about designing, talk about picking location. Mm-hmm. How involved were you in all that stuff? How much did you get of what you wanted? Where did you make sacrifices? Like, how did that all work?
Oh, man. Well, I was involved from the, you know, from the ground up for Tio Lucho's. When my business partner and I toured the facility, we were like, you know, my idea was to transition my pop-up into the brick and mortar. So I was going to take La Chingana and the style of food that I was doing there, which was, you know, a little bit contemporary, not the traditional Peruvian plating. It was more about taking Peruvian flavors and just elevating in a different way, using, you know, whatever was seasonal or just working with local purveyors and whatnot. And I've done a little bit of that at Tio Lucho's, but when we first came in, I was like, this is a huge space. I was picturing something, you know, with like, you know, 6-7 tables, like a little bar counter, you know,
something an extension more, of the pop-up.
Yeah, something a little bit more intimate. And, you know, I walk into Tia Lucho's and I was like, this is like a 150-seater restaurant. Yeah. Like, this is huge.
Yeah.
And so I went home and just re-changed my business plan and decided to open up something that was going to be a little bit more, you know, small plates, shareable plates, and the concept just slowly, you know, transformed to what it is now and evolved into Tia Lucho's. And, you know, I named it Tia Lucho's after my father. He was also a cook. And that was a big inspiration for me. You know, the menu, I wanted to tap into the freshness of what Peruvian food is when it comes to, you know, ceviches and tiraditos.
Yeah.
You know, which is like a Peruvian crudo. And, you know, and then working with the local farmers to bring in that produce and showcase what they got growing, you know?
Yeah, I think with a restaurant of that size, you got to be more to more people because you got to fill more seats. So you need the people that come in just for the ceviche, right? Or the crudo, and then they have some pisco with it or something like that. It's just different. So that's awesome. So when we get back from the break, we're going to go talk through this a little bit more, what you've learned over the past 2 years or so from it, what a Friday and Saturday night look like, what people order in their drinks. We're going to really set the stage, and then we'll transition back more over into what the heck I'm going to do when I'm in Peru so I make sure I cover the right thing. So you've been listening to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3, and we will be right back.
Now back to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3. Nick Constantino here, and we're finishing our conversation with Arnaldo del Castillo, and we're talking about Tia Lucho's. So, Chef, on a Friday night, I'm coming in, my wife and I, we're coming in for dinner. Call it 6:30. Okay. Which is not true. We usually eat at 5 because we have two little nut job kids. So we got to eat like the old senior citizen special. Yeah. But set the perfect table with what a perfect meal is. Talk about what I'm ordering for appetizer, how much time I should spend the drinks. Mm-hmm. Talk about that stuff because I really want to paint a picture and I want to make sure everybody knows how they can find you and how they come share that experience.
Well, if you come into Tia Lucho's at the real time, you say at 5 o'clock, you're going to be able to hit the happy hours. Specials that we have. So, you know, we're going to showcase a couple of cocktails, caipirinhas.
Yep.
You know, like Latin American cocktails.
Sure.
Margaritas, but we'll also have some pisco sours on there. And then as for the snacks, we like to do just like little bites just to, you know, to complement the drinks. It's also the only time in that happy hour where you can do our oysters by the single. So we have three different kinds of oysters. We've got the what I call the naked. So I like to use a lot of Gulf oysters. So right now we got murder points on. The naked ones we just serve with a homemade hot sauce made with Peruvian peppers that are grown here by one of our farmer friends, Jeff over at Pinewood Springs.
Cool.
So he's growing a Gilimos for us. So, and just a little side story, I've been working with him for, I want to say over 5 years and trying to cultivate these Peruvian peppers here in Georgia.
That's cool.
So, you know.
And I think people, one of the things people misunderstand about pepper, they assume hot all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think Peruvian, especially when you have la brasa, chicken pollo la brasa, like the ají amarillo, it's not hot. It's it's very flavorful and it's got a light kick, but you don't always... Peppers don't always mean hot. And I think it's just a poor representation of what cuisine is. So talk about that pepper a little bit more. So you said from Lima, you said?
So the pepper is called ají limo.
Ají limo.
And traditionally that pepper is used in ceviche. So we use it in a multitude of dishes. But just to piggyback off what you said, you know, we use a lot of peppers, but it's to create a foundation for the base of our dishes, you know?
Yeah.
Ají amarillo is one of them. Ají panca is another one. The ají limo gives it heat. So all the peppers have a reasoning for
sure.
It. The panca is going to be a little bit more earthy and you know, it's very similar to guajillo. I like to reference it like that. And then if I want to add a kick to the dish, I'll add some ají limo. And we make our own hot sauce, and I make like a Louisiana-style hot sauce.
Love it.
With the ají limos. And, you know, you can also get our Tia oysters, which are dressed with the leche de tigre.
Love it.
The tiger's milk.
Yep.
And then we have our roasted oysters with hash and ají amarillo bechamel.
Love it. Well, it just shows you're taking things. And like most people, they serve you oysters and they do like a, you know, half-assed mignonette or like they do these things. The fact that you're making hot sauce from scratch and you're not trying to make it Peruvian, you're trying to make it like Tabasco because that's what people are used to.
Yeah.
That I love. It's something people are doing, aren't doing.
I grew up here in the South, so I'm influenced by the techniques. I'm influenced by the dishes, the regional dishes of the South. You know, we have a lot of, you know, we like to fry our snapper in cornmeal. We like to do We have this dish that we'll put on when it gets a little bit colder. In the wintertime, we do a chupe, which is a kind of soup, but our base is like a gumbo base. You know, we make a roux.
Yeah, roux. Wow. So, which is time consuming as can be to make a roux the right way. Like, I've messed with that. It is not easy. It is not easy to do. All right. So we got that. So by the way, not a lot of people in Atlanta do happy hour. Mm-hmm. I know there's some laws and some BS, and I only know because I moved here from DC. Yeah. And DC starting 3 p.m. on Thursday, mm-hmm. the whole city goes nuts for happy hour. There's more people out for you. Oh yeah, there's more people on happy hour than there are for on a Friday night. It's nuts, and it does not stop until Sunday the next morning. People are out partying straight through. And I know it's the laws. You're not allowed to advertise specials and stuff. I know there's rules, but I'm happy you do happy hour, and I'm happy that you've taken the time to put some love into it. So it's a different meal. You're not just discounting. Half size plates. That's what a lot of places do, right? They say it's half price, but they just give you half the serving. They just throw it on the table and be like, that's happy hour.
Right.
So I'm glad. So happy hour, I'm thinking beer. You have any Peruvian beers?
I don't, but I'm working on getting that. And so this is one of the challenges that I've had since opening up a Peruvian restaurant is it's hard to get Peruvian wines, for example. And a lot of people don't think about Peru with having wines because they all kind of lean into the Pisco, which is, you know, big producer of Pisco.
But isn't Mendoza right across the way? Oh, no, that's from Chile. Okay, my bad. I'm confusing myself.
Argentina, but, you know, Argentina and Chile are known for having the wines.
Right.
But to make Pisco, you got to have grapes. So the grape production is huge
Understood.
In Peru.
Got it.
And so the wines are slowly coming into play here. And it actually took me 9 months to bring Peruvian wine to Tio Lucho's. And, you know,
that's in Georgia, right? Because there are probably other states with more restaurants that have it. It's just to get it to Georgia,
Miami,
there's rules. Right. Okay.
But, you know, we were the first restaurant in Atlanta to bring Peruvian wine. And I was able to do that last year, but it took me like 9 months to do that. You know, so
I'm going to throw this in here now because this is what drives me freaking crazy. Okay. So I'm not the biggest one for lists, but the top 50 restaurants in the world is something I've pretty much seen. Right now, there are, I think, 6 restaurants from Peru in the top 100 in the world, and every magazine you read says this is the number one culinary destination in the world right now. Mm-hmm. And the fact that that's the case and we can't get wine from that place into this country is insane. Central was number one last year. Central is the number one restaurant in the world, which means that they must be doing something right. And the fact that it is so complicated to bring those wines in is just insanity to me. I don't understand it. And look, first off, Peru is not a huge country, right? They're not known for a lot of things that they would have these import channels made. But sometimes the global system that we set up does not work in your favor, and that's nuts. So when I'm there, what kind of wines do they make well, and what kind of beers should I look for?
Beers, you know, we like to work with local craft breweries. So I would recommend something from Creature Comforts.
Okay.
I would, on the wine side, I mean, we are slowly adding more Spanish and Latin American wine.
Okay.
So I always like to go into some, like a light Spanish, like a Chacolina maybe.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a little bit of effervescence. I think that pairs really well with the crudos and the ceviches that
we have. Even like a Vino Verde would be something similar. Light with a little fizz, not a champagne, but
exactly.
Yeah. And again, look, I mean, Portuguese cuisine is not that far off too. These things share a lot of similar ancestries and everything. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going into dinner. So me and my wife, we don't get out very often. Let's just throw a bunch of stuff on the table and share it, right? We usually split an entree. You mentioned a snapper. We'd probably get something heavier, steakish, seafood. Again, huge Lomo Saltado guy.
We have Lomo.
I love it. I think for me, the Lomo, one, you got to use the right steak, and two, the french fries have to be good and crispy because I think it just absorbs everything. It's my favorite part. But what would you recommend as a meal for her and I sitting down?
All right, so, you know, if you're gonna start off, you got to start off with one of the tiraditos.
Okay.
I would recommend. We got a beautiful hamachi one right now that we're doing with the coconut leche de tigre.
Ooh.
So
any acid on it?
Oh, for sure.
Because the leche de tigre kind of cuts the acid a little bit. Is that the purpose of it?
The leche de tigre is made with a lot of citrus, a lot of lime juice. There's also some other ingredients in there like ginger, garlic.
This is
what we call tiger's milk. And I always say this is the cure all for anything. If you got any ailments, if you had too many pisco sours the night before, have some leche de tigre the next day.
I love it. That's like, so when I lived in Vegas, we had Mexican neighbors, and that's what menudo is for the Mexicans. Like, if the world ends and you're hungover, just eat intestines. Here's your menudo. And I did it so many times, and it worked almost every, I don't think it would work at this age, but when I was younger.
Right?
So
start out with the hamachi tiradito. You know, we bring in this beautiful hamachi, Japanese tuna, and, you know, we do sashimi slices. And so that's the difference between a tiradito and a ceviche. A ceviche is going to be cubed fish.
Right.
And the tiradito is going to be sliced.
Thin.
And that's where that Nikkei influence comes from.
And that's like a crudo, but they do.
Like a crudo.
And a hamachi is a sushi grade. Yeah, yeah. that's That's crazy. Okay, so that you had me. That's a great start.
You're starting off with something light. Now you're gonna go into, you know, a little bit of a smaller plate.
Yep.
And I recommend the corn fritter bowl that we just have on there. It's okay. Influenced by tortitas, which is a type of corn fritter that is from northern Peru. And what we do is we take yellow corn, we take Peruvian white corn, and then we grate all of that, and then we add this hush puppy base to it.
Cool. Hush puppy south. Yeah. Right?
So we're incorporating a little bit of cornmeal into this mixture, and then we do these fritters, and we're serving them now with a whipped honey butter. So it's kind of like our bread service kind of thing.
Cool.
And
but that's painstaking, right? You just said the hard thing. Like cornmeal is, in this country, is probably genetically modified and just thrown in, and it's easy to make. If you're shaving actually off of the corn husk, that's a completely different dish.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's just a completely
different. We're adding a fresh element to this, yeah. And
but you're not breaking, you're not mocking the way they do it in the South. You're just adding a little lightness and a little
Peruvian
mix.
Dish, but it
Love
just
it.
Has that little Southern twang to it. You know?
Love it.
Then we've got I'm a big fan of the octopus that we have on right now. So we do a charred tomato vinaigrette. It's got ají panca. It's got ají mirasol in it. So different peppers that add body, but doesn't add any heat to the fish. And then we slow poach this this octopus for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So it gets nice and tender, fork tender, not too chewy.
Yeah.
It doesn't just like melt in your mouth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a little.
My grandmother is from Italy. My mother was born in Italy, but she would take a chain, like a chain link fence, and she would beat the octopus with the chain to tenderize it.
A YouTube video about that.
Yeah. No, that was my grandmother. She was 80 years old, and she had a chain, like she was going into a fight, like wrapped around her hand, and she was just beating the crap out of the octopus.
That's how
they tenderize it. Yeah. So, I mean, crazy world, but anyway.
Yeah. Some people like to throw the wine corks in there.
Yeah.
Or if the potato, you throw in a potato, when the potato's done, the octopus is done.
Something like that.
We just put it in an aromatic broth and we just let it slow roll.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's nice and tender. And then we add this anticucho marinade to it. Typically that marinade is reserved for beef hearts. So when you're in Lima and you're seeing the street vendors and you see the beef hearts, they're going to do the anticucho marinade on that. We like to take that and apply it to the octopus. So there's a lot of cumin behind it. There's a lot of annatto seed.
And there's nothing more different in the world than octopus and beef hearts.
Oh, yeah,
just the taste and just the texture and the graininess. I mean, I love a beef heart, chicken heart the right way.
Yeah.
I've also had it the wrong way. It's not a good experience. So,
yeah.
All right, that's awesome. So, you know, You covered some of the Japanese. You guys do a chaufa? You do a, because you get a little Chinese fried rice influence, right?
Fried rice, yeah.
Yeah, so talk about that one.
Man, my dad was a big fan of chifa, which is the Chinese Peruvian.
Influence, right.
Right? And so he would always go to the Chinatown in Peru in Lima.
Yeah.
Which is downtown. And, you know, he knew all the spots. And he kind of, you know, shared that passion with me. And so, yeah, I wanted to honor him by putting on a chaufa dish. We do it with seafood style. So we do little neck clams. We also do some Georgia shrimp on there as well as some Gulf shrimp.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do it head on so you can get all those flavors in there.
Yeah, which is not something you see at Chinese restaurants often. It's pork and they just overcook the crap out of it. You got to be very delicate with your hand when you're using that much seafood in a dish, especially like fried rice, because overcooked seafood just is not going to help that dish at all.
No. But the thing is, you know, we do it on a wok, so we do it the traditional style.
Good for you.
And, you know, it's quick. It's fast paced. I mean, that dish comes out in like 3 minutes because you just got to get your wok ripping hot. And then once you start, boom.
Love it, dude.
Yeah.
Love it. I am freaking hungry. This has helped me build the appetite for when I finally get down to Lima. What about dessert? What's your favorite?
Dessert. I recommend the picarones.
Okay.
And this is the version that we do it sort of like a little donut holes.
Cool.
And my wife actually came up with this. She's not a pastry chef. She's not classically trained.
Sure.
She just watched a lot of the Great British Baking Show.
That's funny.
But she's a fantastic baker. So when I was doing my pop-ups, you know, and I did the tasting menu, I would do all the savory and she would do the desserts.
Cool.
And, you know, she's from, you know, down the street. She's here from Georgia. So she's never had Peruvian food until she met me. And the fact that I was able to, like, tell her, hey, I want these flavor profiles. And she took that and then developed and created her own desserts.
Yeah, she can wing it.
Bro.
She could wing it. And it's one of the problems with those classically trained chefs. When you get into French baking cuisines, like you're so butter heavy, it's really hard to have other flavors shine through. So you got to go so heavy handed with it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it, man. So what do Americans get wrong about pisco and how do you use pisco in your drinks? Because my wife was born in Puerto Rico. So I have a Latin family and my father-in-law who's been all over the world with the Peace Corps and a lot of other stuff, but he loves pisco. So he drinks it everywhere he goes. It's his thing. He likes Amaro from Europe and he likes pisco. Talk about, pisco's broad, right? There's a lot of different kinds and flavor profiles.
Yeah.
Talk about what Americans get wrong about pisco and why one should order something on a menu if they see it.
What they get, I don't know if they get anything wrong. I mean,
haven't tried it.
I'll say this. Pisco, for it to be classified pisco, it has to come from Peru.
Okay.
So Chile also has a big production of pisco, but it's not classified. Pisco is classified as brandy. So if you're going to get something that has pisco on it, I encourage you to get something from Peru.
Okay.
And now they have different varieties because they use different grapes. At Tia Lucho's, we have all of these varieties for you to you know, sample. But the pisco sour, which is the national cocktail of Peru, it uses, you know, some people like to use quebranta variety, which is a little smoother pisco.
Okay.
Acholado has a little bit of heat behind it. It almost reminds me of like a mezcal.
Okay.
And, you know, right now we're using acholado, and a pisco sour is lime juice. It's simple syrup, pisco, and then we like to do it in a little apricot liqueur because it adds a little bit of body to the pisco. And then we add egg whites. And so
yeah, I was gonna there whip them up a little bit, get some foam on the top. Yeah, right, when you shake it up, you get the foam on the top.
That foam smooths out that heat from that pisco variety. You know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love it. I'm starving first off, but I think, you know, you're making it, you're normalizing it for people too. You're not coming in and seeing these crazy things on a menu. You're seeing things that you're comfortable with. You're seeing ingredients that you know, mm-hmm. which makes it more willing to try new things. And I think sometimes people go one of two extremes. They go too little of the influence and they call it Peruvian and there's one dish on there, mm-hmm. or they go too Peruvian and you're scaring away half the people because they don't want a shrimp head on. Mm-hmm. You know, again, you should if you're from the South, if you know you're doing the right way. But So because it is a marketing show and we haven't touched marketing at all, talk a little bit of it was like marketing the pop-up. Talk a bit to like about using the PR firm and how you market, because, you know, one of the things I've learned, the time has changed, right? It used to be you make a good restaurant, people hear about you and come. Now you can make the best restaurant in the world if you're not playing SEO right, if you're not playing these games, if you're Google, if you're not doing the things, talk what you've learned about marketing and how you approached marketing for the restaurant.
Well, you know, marketing for the pop-up when I first started, I knew that I needed to get the word out. If no one knows what I'm doing, if no one hears about it or sees it, then I'm not really marketing my dinners the right way. So, you know, it was very important because I was doing these intimate dinners for only like 20, 30 people. So my goal was to always sell out.
Yep.
And I used social media to create awareness. So I would talk about the ingredients that I'm preparing and getting ready for, the ingredients that I'm purchasing. I would talk about, you know, put a bunch of stories on Instagram, do paid ads on Facebook just to get that traction going. So I tapped into the social media heavy with the pop-up. Now that, you know, we have the brick and mortar, there's other avenues for us to use.
Yeah.
You know, the websites, the Google and all that.
Yeah. I see here James Beard semifinalist.
Yeah.
Did that help? Yeah, I was going to say. So
we got busy.
Well, look, James Beard existed for the longest time.
Yeah.
Actually, I saw a documentary about him. The story is not quite what people think it is. It's a pretty crazy story when you find out the whole thing. But, you know, when you become into these places of notoriety, did you know that you were going to be a semifinalist? And were you ready for the rave of demand? I mean, if you're watching Google Analytics, you probably see a spike in organic search because all these people are now looking for you.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, are they douchey? Are they foodies that come in and think they know everything when these people are coming in because of James Beard? Are they a different customer?
Our business doubled overnight. Like, our reservations, you know, doubled overnight. It was fantastic. I didn't know that I was going to get this. A buddy of mine, actually, for a chef in Charleston, of Nico of Cultura, hit me up, and he was saying something like, you know, congrats or whatever.
Yeah.
And I thought he was just like talking about a pop-up dinner that we did like a year before.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, man, miss you too, or something like that. And he was like, bro, we're on the James Beard. Because he also was nominated for Best Emerging Chef. And I was like, get the out of here, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was fantastic, man.
Was that part of the vision board? Were you working towards that? Was that something you wanted? Because, I mean, look, Atlanta didn't even have a Michelin guide until recently. Like, these things were just not topically part of this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I come from New York City. They've been doing these things for their ever. There's all these places have been on these lists forever. But was it something that you wanted? Is something that you thought you wanted? Or was it something that you didn't even know you're working towards? You're like, oh, my God, that's pretty cool.
No, was not really on our to-do list. or even on mine, you know.
Which is so crazy because you had everything planned out. You knew you were taking this for generational wealth. You wanted all this, and that wasn't on the list, which probably made it that much more authentic.
I think my goal was just to make sure that we have a restaurant where the food, the drinks, and the service is top-notch. And so that's what I always aspire, and that's what I always tell my management team is just to, you know, always strive to make sure that we hit it out of the park with these things. And I think that's what helps us get that recognition.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's... It's, I mean, it's fantastic now, and you know, it's really cool to feel, you know, valued that way.
Yeah, I love it. What about your regulars? So one of the things I do know about a restaurant is without regulars, you're a flash in the pan, you'll be open for 2 years, and then you got to change your concept or something because regulars, what's the neighborhood? Have you adjusted to the neighborhood? Have you really embraced the community? Are they embracing you? Do you have regulars coming in? How's that work?
Yeah, we've got regulars. We're right below a residential building. So we got apartments up top, and so a lot of our regular base comes from that. But we're also in a neighborhood. We're in Ponce Highlands.
Yeah.
We're down the street from Virginia Highlands and in between Inman Park. So, you know, a lot of the people that come to check us out are people, you know, it could be first-timers, but it's also a bunch of regulars, you know, that they come in. You know, our place is you know, cater more for adults and you know, large parties and whatnot. And I think we do a great job, you know, because we're niche as well, you know, we're the only Peruvian restaurant in the city of Atlanta. And what we're doing is also a little bit contemporary. So we're not doing these super traditional Peruvian plates. You know, we're doing something that's a little bit more elevated.
Yeah. Yeah. I like, cause there are some Pollo La Brasa places. Mm-hmm. I know there's one Indicator.
Fantastic, yeah.
It's real. Oh my God. If you get it done the right way, man. If
you gotta try our pollo though.
I'm coming, man. I'm telling you, I'm coming. I gotta ship the kids away for a little while, but I'm coming. And I love the sauces they put, the green and white sauce with that they put on Pollo La Brasa. It's done the right way. And so look, dude, this has been great. I am more excited to go to Peru. Honestly, I'm excited to see it. I'm excited to come check you out. We got 3 minutes left. Tell me when I'm in Peru, the things I have to do. Like, is it getting seafood? Is it go to Chinatown? What do I have to do? What do I have to try while I'm there?
I took my wife for the first time last year.
Okay.
So I would recommend go to Chinatown. So you got to go downtown.
Okay.
Tour the catacombs.
Okay.
You know, cramped spaces. I hope you're not claustrophobic.
Yeah, I'll be all right.
It's fun. And when you're in downtown, you can visit all the old school chifa joints.
Okay.
So you can try that what Peruvian chifa is like. From then, you can definitely make some reservations at like Lamar.
Yep.
You can get Central. Go to Central.
Yeah.
I had a fantastic meal there.
We got three. So we got Maido. We got the Japanese. All the three that were on the top 50 list, I got reservations for.
Awesome.
So I'm excited for that. And I think the exchange rate helps there because it'd probably be a $1,200 meal in the U.S., but I'm excited for that part of it.
Yeah. Go to the neighborhood of Barranco.
Okay.
It's a little bit more, you know, eclectic, but there's one of the restaurants that I ate there was also on the world's top 50 list.
Cool.
Venezuelan chef using Peruvian ingredients.
Love it.
Man, it was a fantastic meal.
It's a culinary city though, right? Most lunchtime, you're going to get a meal at lunchtime. I mean, like everywhere you go. What about breakfast? Anything off the top of your head for breakfast, just to make sure I do?
Breakfast, go to, there's a restaurant called Tanta.
Okay.
If you're going to be, are you staying in like Miraflores? Are you staying in
San Isidro? I think we're staying at the Hyatt Central, right in the middle of everything.
Yeah. So you're overlooking
the water.
The water. Beautiful. Awesome restaurants around there.
Good.
But they also have a really nice buffet at that hotel.
We shall see. Well, at least you know to the specifics of where the buffet is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, we're excited. One of the things that, like, I used to be the biggest Yelp guy in the world just because you pop up a new place, you hit it, he finds it. Yeah. But, like, Eater has done a really good job. And Eater's got a list of 40 restaurants in freaking Lima. Like, that's insane that there's 40. There's other lists of, like, the top ones. That's just, like, have to go in Lima is 38. That's when you know in your culinary city. Mm-hmm. I mean, Peru is Atlanta and Florida together are 5 times the size of Peru, and they have 38 restaurants, which is just crazy. So I'm really excited for it. Tell them how to find you on the web. Tell them to find you on socials and tell them how to come find you for dinner.
Yeah, find us on social media, on Instagram at Tio Luchos. You know, tioluchos.com. You can make your reservations for lunch or dinner there. We're on Resy. We're on the hit list right now.
So
come check us out. Come try our chickens, our ceviches. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Chef, I appreciate this. The next segment will actually be me coming back from Peru, and I'm going to do it live there. Screw it. So let's see if he knows what he's talking about. You listen to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3, and we'll catch you next week.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men, Extra 106.3. We are live from Lima. We are sitting here on the cliffs of Miraflores. So quick breakdown. It's been an amazing trip. The city has pyramids in the middle of just the middle of the street, just sitting there, just pyramids. So many empires, so many people have been here. Huge city, 10 million people. We've eaten well, we've drank well, we've seen a lot. We had a hotel in San Isidro. We've been down to Barranco. We've been everywhere you can possibly be in the 3 days that we were here. So we're going to give you a quick breakdown of everything, pictures, videos, everything we've had. But it's been an amazing trip. Shout out to Chef, who gave some recommendations. And if you can get down here, get to Lima. It's an amazing place.
First, some history. Lima is a city of about 10 million people, which is a huge amount of people, very populated, made me feel a lot like where I was born in New York City. It is separated into zones, about 40 or so of these zones. Again, huge, sprawling mega city. We spent most of our time, probably like most tourists, in the old city, the cultural center, Miraflores, which is the neighborhood on the water, wealthy neighborhood, Barranco, which was kind of the bohemian hipster vibe area, and then San Isidro, which our hotel was at, and it's kind of the business district. The weather doesn't vary much. It's between 60 and 80 degrees of all times. It is on the southern hemisphere, so it's opposite seasons of ours. And they only get about 4 inches of rain a year. That being said, there is some interesting flora, trees, animals. Everything is a little odd. Even though it only rains 4 inches a year, the water puts this misty humidity off that allows all these crazy trees to grow. So, for example, it is a desert. It is arid, but there are also palm trees. So you have cacti and palm trees on top of each other, literally growing out of the same soil. It's insane. Again, that mist also made it kind of weird and dreary. And you know, in San Diego, they call it June gloom, but kind of gloomy. But eventually it would burn off and it would be as hot as can be because the sun is also so strong. So again, unique temperature. And that temperature is what sets up a lot of what makes this city so interesting. So tourist attractions, we did a lot of walking. Like most big cities, it's great. The best thing you can do is walk it. So we walked about 30 miles. The main tourist attractions that stood out were the main art museum, the Basilica of St. Francis, and the ruins of Puncana. The art museum told a great story of all the different parts of the history, from the native people to the Incas to the Spanish conquistadors, everything. You can see all these different areas of influence that come in. The Basilica, insane history and art, Baroque style, Nouveau style, and then there were gold everywhere. The coolest part, in addition to the stories that they told of the Franciscans and history, was definitely the catacombs below. So for those that don't know, catacombs are pretty much underground caves of bones and bodies and grave sites. So we got to see the largest catacombs outside of Rome, outside the Vatican, and it was crazy to see. They're just bones and skulls lying there. Babies, people, just watching it. So I would think that was the most haunted place, that is, until we got to the ruins. So the ruins at Pulcana were literally in the dead middle of the city. We saw that 2,000 years of history following from the ancient civilizations to where they would bury people, to where they rose up to the top of the city, to where the Incas started burying people. Pretty much it was buried, and they just started excavating about 20 years ago. It'll take another 30 to 40 years for them to excavate this the full way. But again, the craziest part is that this is in the dead middle of the city. You walk up this hill, and all of a sudden you're surrounded on all sides by buildings. It was just wild. The last attraction had to be the water by itself. You walk, and it's about probably a 20-mile stretch of parks, museums. There was even a mall built into the cliffs. So you walk to the edge, and you're hanging off cliffs over the water. It was really, really cool. Once the sun did pop out, you were seeing people surfing and paragliding. I mean, the activity out there was insane, which, for what it's worth, made me kind of stop and think a second about how poorly set up we are in the U.S. for this. Everything requires a car. You don't see the families out there playing. You saw generations, grandparents, grandkids, parents, all out there together, friends, everyone kind of just hanging out in these plazas. It's a really incredible sight to see, and it's something you just don't unfortunately see here. The family unit is so separated, and we don't have parks in these gathering places. It's upsetting to see, but that's what it is. That's why you go places like this and explore, and it was quite an experience to do so. All right, so now to the good stuff. So we took chef's advice on a lot of this, but I was most interested in the food. Lima is one of the top culinary destinations in the world. So I'm going to go into what we did, what we saw, where we ate with a little context. First off, let's start kind of in a row just of what we did. So number one was called Kehoe. Kehoe is the number 28 restaurant in the world right now. Same people who started Central a couple of years ago. And their claim to fame is it is a culinary walk, if you will, through the different parts and geographies and topographies of Peru.
So from the ocean to the desert to the mountains, for a country of 30 million people, there is a lot of different flora and fauna and topographies and geographies and weather patterns. So this is a pretty much one of those, what you can imagine, a huge 8-course tasting menu, really cool space. The standout items on our menu, which just seems to be a seasonal one, were the scallops, the tubers, and tubers, all seven kinds of vegetables all put together on this plate, and then the lobster dish. It was an amazing experience, one you wouldn't do every year. It was quite expensive, but for what it's worth, it was one of those anniversary meals that makes it worth its while. Only point of frustration, it seems as if they do a good job of not letting anyone know how much the meal costs. I read from $150 to $200, and the menu doesn't say what it is. So when you get to the end, it's kind of a guessing game on a bill. I don't care who you are, seeing a $600 bill makes the meal different. And it was the only point of frustration. It seems as since they've made the top 50 list, the price has steadily increased, and they've done a good job of suppressing that price. I don't know why they do it. I recommend against it. I was going to pay that amount anyway, and it kind of feels like a kick in the nuts to get a bill that high at the end. But that being said, it was quite an experience. I really dug Peruvian Chinatown. China is one of the first countries in the world to open their borders to Chinese immigrants. Peru was one of the first countries in the world to open its border to Chinese immigrants, and it's been a race since. So it's one of the largest Chinatowns in the world, and they have their own cuisine called Chifa, which is Peruvian Chinese hybrid. So traditional Chinese food. We wanted to keep actually traditional on purpose. Being a New Yorker, I love my Chinese food. So we stayed with pretty much fried rice, shumai, and wonton soup. So the food felt familiar and comfortable, but at the same time, there was more flavor, less salt. It tasted more like a mix of those things. And the coolest part by far, though, was that when you go to most Chinatowns, all the people there are Chinese. In New York, Philly, San Francisco, anywhere I've been, it's a huge Chinese population. For whatever reason, in Peru, it's all Peruvians that work here. So you really feel this mixture of cultures. And it was a cool thing. It's right by the old city. It was a great thing to experience. Next, also Matria. Matria was another top 50 restaurant in the world. Pretty much seemed feel like a neighborhood bar. Like you're just sitting there at the restaurant. There's plants built into the building. You're halfway outside. We got blue crab, which was the crab legs kind of hanging out, and then the body of the crab all built into this dip almost, like you would do with mussels or like a barbecue shrimp dish, and you just scooped it all up. Insane. So good. And then we had the lomo saltado, which is a dish you have to try. Interesting. It was complex but simple, and they have French fries, soy sauce, and ají amarillo, which is their yellow chili sauce that we talked about with Chef, all coming together for this weird texture and diversity of, but it is unbelievable. It's something to check out. A lot of places do make it now, so check it out if you can. We also stopped at a place called Primo's for pollo a la brasa, something you have to do. You have to try it out. Ají amarillo, they cook it the right way on a rotisserie. You can tell they've been making this dish for hundreds, if not 200s of years. It was unbelievable. And then lastly, we tried some Nikkei cuisine, which again, in addition to the Chinese influence, there's a huge Japanese influence. Nikkei cuisine is the one to look out for. Across the world, you will see this starting to spread. In fact, the restaurant we ate at, Osaka, is now in Dubai. It's made its way to the Middle East. It's in the U.S., so it's spreading all over the world. Quite good. I liked it. I'm not the biggest fan just because it is similar enough to Japanese cuisine that it's hard to change it, but you could definitely see those Peruvian influences and flavors, and it was quite a meal. Last, and I think the most fun I had, the most surprising thing, was the cocktail culture here. The cocktails were so much love went into it, almost as much as a dish. There was one that took 10 minutes to make. And the way they froth the egg and they put the pico in, there's spices, and you could just tell they put love into it and they really embrace it. We went to a place called Carnival. Carnival is a top 50 bar in the world. It's a crazy setup, but you walk in and there's this menu that you open, and as you open the pages, it actually reads like a book, and it's showing you the history and how these Incan characters come in to make these drinks. So one of the drinks I had was actually looked like a flute, and you can actually play it like a flute, which would be gimmicky everywhere else, but here the vibe just worked. So it was an awesome place. Guys throwing fire around as they're making drinks everywhere. And then, of course, I'd be remiss to forget my best friend, DJ Momo, who had headphones on and talked to you while you drank and came in this huge, intricate thing with golden chocolate. Now, I had some of that, the glitter on my face, so it looked like I had gone to a strip club, but those are different in Peru, so we'll save that conversation for a different time. So all in all, it was an amazing trip. Thank you to Chef for letting me know the breakdown. I'm glad I got to bring it to you live from here in Peru.
You've listened to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3, and we'll catch you next week.